This is Dawn Ray, and I'm your host for The Jump. This podcast is all about inspiring change, courage, and confidence, building grit. I'm an executive coach and speaker. I've worked for 20 years as a finance executive in New York City and London. I've also attended Georgetown Law and Boston College, and I'm a New York qualified lawyer. I've studied personal development, performance, including sports psychology, and resilience for 15 years. I'll be giving you the techniques, mindset frameworks, and high performance strategies to finally do the thing that you're scared to do, that jump, because that, my friends, is where the level up is. This is The Jump, parachute required. Hi, I'm Dawn Marie. I am your host for the podcast called The Jump. And thank you for joining me for the very second episode. In case you're at all curious, I still don't know what the fuck I'm doing. But I am determined to record a few episodes today. And so just to give you an idea, if you're hearing me only, you can't see this, but like, see that behind me? That's all nice background, like with a cool like little movie thing. See that over there? That's got like books. There's a cool couch. There's a plant. It's fake. I never lie to you. I have no idea how to get that into this shot, but I'm doing it anyway. And today's episode is going to tell you a little bit about my background, because I think that's the only way that I can earn your trust is by telling you a little bit about me and why I'm pretty good at what I do. Though I could be wrong on that too. I don't have all the answers for you. And I know there's a lot of podcasts out there. I think this one's going to be a little bit different. So about me, I am 100% Colombian. I'm 45. I've been a digital nomad for 2 years. At 44, I decided to do a complete career pivot. And that was in July of 2023. And I had been doing executive coaching part-time for 2 years whilst I had my fairly lucrative regulatory consulting practice in London. And so when I worked as a interim C-level executive, so an interim or contract-based chief compliance officer, I still kind of, I can't really comment on that. Interim chief compliance officer, interim chief operating officer. I had my own little company in London, which I still had, and I got paid a daily rate. So when I first started contracting, I got about $500 a day. And then through balls to the wall negotiation, I was able to scale that up to just under $2,000 a day. And for a woman in London, that's pretty strong. Asset management is not an easy industry. It is cutthroat. It is fucking brutal as F. It is terrifying for both men and women. Equally terrifying. I think for women in particular, it is really, really tough because we are the minority. And if you get to that C-suite status as a woman, like, I'm sorry, but you are a effing warrior. Like, if you can last through everything that you have to go through in asset management and finance as a woman to finally get to that either director or managing director, C-suite kind of role, like freaking not just slow clap, like big clap, big clap. I know I'm not supposed to clap in front of the microphone. I still have no idea if this thing freaking works. Okay. All right. So I went to Georgetown Law School, and Boston College. I graduated from Georgetown Law in 2008, and I had, this was during the time of the massive worldwide economic collapse. In case you live under a rock or weren't around for that. And if you weren't, like, well done, because that was a bad, dark times. Although in consideration of the presidency coming up, in 2024, I think we're headed for some more dark times. But it's always darkest before the law. I had to throw that in there because I'm cheesy and weird. So yeah, 2008 was a rough one for me. I graduated with $250,000 of debt, student loan debt for putting myself through law school. And some of that debt is on 8% interest rate. And I still have quite a bit of it. And that's the reality for bettering yourself in America through education, right? If you pay for it yourself, you get yourself into a tremendous amount of debt. And normally it would be, you can immediately pay it off because you went to a really good school and you would go into a really big law firm that pays you a lot of money to sell your soul. But you will get a lot of money and then you will use that money to pay off the degree, right? Except there were two things. One, I kind of sucked at law school. I was damn good at contracts. I'm very good at contract law. And I'm really good at like negotiation. I was good at private equity, venture capital, negotiation law. Everything else I kind of sucked at. So I graduated with a 2.97. So if, for those of you who aren't familiar with American grading system, a 3.0 is a straight B, 2.97 is just under a B, and a 4.0 is a perfect grade, right? And yeah, my grades weren't great. And 2.97 combined with 2008 economic collapse and all of these law firms laying off all of their partners and associates during 2008, there just wasn't any work, right? And if there was for work out there, it was for students who had better grades than me. And I'd say that was one of, I think we all have these moments in our life where we think it's all going in this right direction, right? This right trajectory. And then something happens, like a catastrophic event. For me, it was 08. And you know what? In comparison to other people, like that probably isn't even catastrophic. For me, it was. And for other people, it might be a heart attack. It might be a massive divorce. It might be finding out the love of their life has been having an affair for 5 years. It could be, you know, health, wealth, relationships. Those are the three areas. So for me, that was a big thing that went wrong. But it developed in me this sense of becoming a warrior. It required me to redefine success because so many had deemed me a failure, to be honest with you. I used to call it hate mail. So in law school, you apply for all these associate positions, right? And I applied for all these associate positions in law school. And like it was no after no after no. Like, and when I would get the next letter, I'd be like, oh, here's some more hate mail. And it was a no, 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 no. There's a lot of reasons for this. My first year in law school, I didn't do the typical thing of working for free. This is because I went to law school later in life. I went when I was like 25 or 26. And so for a lot of students, like they'll go to Georgetown, they'll go to any law school. They'll go to university first for 4 years and then they graduate and they go to law school and they kind of get everything done. I had been working on Wall Street in New York City for about 5 years. I was in New York during September 11th, which is another story, which we're not going to get into here for today. And so, yeah, I took some time to work first. And in finance, everything is transaction-based. So people who performed really well at Bloomberg made a lot of money, had nothing to do with the hours that they did. It was transaction-based. And so I never really put it together that law was not going to be transaction-based, that it would be this hourly slog, right? Law is based upon you as a partner, as an associate, whatever it are, it is hours, hours of your life. And so I rebelled against that. I mean, I'm not exactly conservative and I struggle with conformity, but I embrace that now. But I struggled with it for my first year. I just thought, well, this seems ridiculous. Why the hell would I work for any law firm for free during my first year? I'm going to fuck off and go to Nantucket and bartend. And during that time, I kind of built up my first entrepreneurial venture, which was about divorce consulting. Divorce consulting for high net worth clientele who were going through really expensive divorces and needed someone to come in and kind of clarify what was taking so long. Why were the legal costs going up? And in that regard, you know, with a lot of high net worth divorces, like they can cost couples like at least a couple hundred grand, if not a couple hundred, then a couple million, candidly. And this happens. And what I saw was a gap in the market, right? I saw that two intelligent people who've accumulated wealth would think like three-year-olds. And they would call their lawyer, who costs between, I don't know, 700 to 3,000 an hour, and bitch and moan and act and call their lawyer with stuff that they really should be calling their therapist about and or a consultant, because it would be just like noise, like blah, 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 about the cat, blah, 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 about the painting, blah, 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 about the house or the car or whatever the heck it is. And I could see so clearly how illogical they were being. And so I picked up a few clients there. It was like just like practice. Like I was just practicing, right? That was my first entrepreneurial venture. And candidly, there should have been signs then that I should drop out of law school. It wasn't working for me. It was so clear that I was not as smart as the other people at Georgetown. I mean, they could read books. I had a friend, Corey, he had a photographic memory. So we would, do you know what it's like to study for a law school exam with someone with a photographic memory? So we would be studying for stuff, and I do not have a photographic memory. At least, sure as shit, not for law stuff. I can memorize different pages of Robin Sharma's book or Brendan Burchard's book or Ed Milet or Brené Brown. I memorize what they write, but law school was very different for me. And so I found myself amongst all of these super smart people who seemed to be smart without even trying. They were smart in a way that I wasn't. And so law school, you know, Georgetown is a beautiful university, but that was a really hard experience for me. And I thought if I just stuck it through, it would work. It would be okay. So I stuck it through, and then I graduated in 08, and it's $250,000 of student loan debt because I don't come from any money, and I paid my way through, and I took on all that debt, not really understanding the ramifications of student loan debt. I sure as shit do now. And, you know, my life kind of fell apart in 08. It's not to say that, like, this is a sob story, because I wouldn't change any of it. I wouldn't change any of it. It made me who I am. I mean, I am pretty freaking powerful just on my own two feet. I'm very different than, I think differently than most of mainstream society. But if you can get yourself out of that situation, 08, and then out of every single situation I would get myself into when I was traveling solo through all of these countries in these really remote places. I mean, even like Iceland, people are thinking, oh, Iceland's so beautiful. Not the part that I saw. I decided to get into the car. I don't know. This microphone is on. I think it's on. So I get in the car in Iceland. This car is not fit for purpose. When I traveled, I was not doing five-star luxury stuff. Like I was roughing it. Sometimes I would stay in hostels, and then finally I stopped. So I would do Airbnbs. I would be traveling alone. I would get a cheap car. This was stupid in Iceland, right? You don't want a cheap car. It was a manual car as well, because remember, in Europe, everything is a manual car. It's not automatic. Separate story on that. That's probably for the next episode. Anyway, I jumped down a rabbit hole, but 2008 was rough. I made it work, right? I made it work. And, you know, almost 20 years later, but, you know, well, really 15, 16 years later, here I am reinventing myself as a speaker and as a coach. And I've been coaching for a little over 2 years, but I wasn't doing it full time, right? I started studying personal development and leadership and communication psychology, organizational psychology, neuroscience, mindfulness, mindset habits, growth mindset, high performance habits. I started studying the coaches of NFA and which is National Football Association or NBA players, Kobe Bryant. Started studying Kobe Bryant in 08 and 09 because I had to reinvent my idea of success. And I had to save myself from extreme depression and debilitating anxiety and anxiety attacks. My anxiety attacks, you know, I still have a few as you know, 15 years later, I still have a few. Usually they're around tech instead of around debt or student loan debt and money. You know, the things that live in your body, your fears, they never really go away. You can process them and you can heal them, but I wouldn't say that you ever conquer completely things like depression and anxiety. I think that those two pieces will always, of me, will always be with me. For a long time, a very long time, I would never talk about my anxiety or my depression or 08 or my student loan debt or even my GPA. And then I realized that the only way for me to truly be free is to start telling my story. And I thought it would be mainly through a book because I love to write more than anything else in the world. I love to write. And I think it's one of the things that I'm good at. I believe that we all have at least three things that we're really good at. And writing is one of them for me. But then I also realized that I have a voice. I guess part of doing this podcast is a kind of a, you know, a fuck you to all those bosses that I had when I was in finance who would just tell me to shut the fuck up. I went to Georgetown Law School and I cannot believe how I was treated in finance. And it wasn't just me. I think a lot of women deal with a lot of stuff. Now, that is not to say I am anti-man or a raging feminist. I'm an equalist. I'm an equalist and I'm a humanist. But still, all that being said, you know, it's hard. It's a hard thing now that I'm out of that industry. Of course, I'll coach and I'll come in to speak with certain firms. You know, and have workshops and stuff like that. But now that I'm out of that industry, you know, I realize what having to constantly fight to be heard or to have a voice or a seat at the table when I'm just as smart as anyone else at that table, candidly. Finance taught me a lot, right? Because there would be guys there that couldn't spell cat, but they'd be responsible for 20 people. And I would watch them. I would watch everything about them. I'd watch how they walk into a room, how they sit, how they communicate over email. I mean, I'd been reading books on psychology and the behavioral sciences, especially around organizational change independently since 08, right? So by the time I was in my 40s, I got really good at watching when people don't know any idea what they're doing, but but they somehow have gained responsibility for that. That largely came down to politics and knowing how to play the game. I suck at politics, even in personal development. You know, I've only been in the industry 9 months and I've already told off a pretty big player in this field because I disagreed with the sales practices of something, which I will not get into today, but I'm a controversial, ballsy little bitch. And when I feel that something is wrong, when I feel that people are being taken advantage of or not treated correctly, I say something and I am fearless about it. And it always would shock these millionaires and these billionaires and hedge funds, and sure shit shocked this big guy in like personal development. I don't think this man has ever been told what someone really thinks. But yeah, separate topic for a different day. So where was I? Certainly, 08 didn't end up like I thought it would. I didn't end up at the big law firm. I didn't become a partner or associate. I didn't jump in house to become general counsel. My life went in a really different direction. I ended up moving from the U.S. I went, you know, again, I went to Georgetown, Washington, D.C. I moved to London. And then from there, I actually worked my way back up. So I started out as a temp receptionist. Then I worked in RFP, marketing, compliance, kind of a hybrid role, which I created for myself. Then I started writing a paper about AIFMD and Frank Dodd, Dodd-Frank Act. We can tell that it really, you know, was written on my soul, that paper. But I studied AIFMD and Dodd-Frank because I was just like, you know what? God gave me a brain. I can figure this out. As I was studying that, I then got headhunted to work at the FCA for a little bit. FCA stands for the Financial Conduct Authority. That was a contractual role. And that was that role and that experience is what really changed and opened up a lot of doors for me. So I had a team of four or five people that I was responsible for there. And there were a couple of other there were like two or three other lawyers and two or three other MBAs, and there was about 30 contractors working for the FCA implementing AIFMD. It was the first regulation of its kind, and it was very exciting. It was a short-term contract. I think it was like anywhere between 6 or 8 months, but then that then opened up doors. I ended up working for a consulting firm called Cordium, which is a compliance consulting firm, which now became ACA Compliance, and I was there for just about a year, which is a long time for me. And from there, then I was headhunted to be the chief compliance officer at a small asset manager with about $3 billion under management. And they did credit, which it was not an easy thing to learn. And I sat next to the general counsel and I picked up a thing or two. And it was a really good company with really, really good people. I loved the people there. And so I stayed there for just about 3 years. I stayed at that company longer than I stayed at any other company in my entire 45 years of life, which really actually says a lot. There were good people there. And I'm still good friends with a few of them. I'll always be grateful for that experience. From there, I started getting into short-term roles. Contractual role. So I took on a role that was a chief operating officer and chief compliance officer, some kind of hybrid role. And I went into a private equity firm. From there, then I went into another private equity firm. Then I started jumping into hedge fund contracts. And I kind of just jumped around a bit and always negotiated higher rates. So what I would do is I would go on a solo remote trip, put myself in the middle of fucking nowhere, balls the wall, test my limits, climb a couple of mountains, literally, or, you know, swim at midnight when you shouldn't be swimming at midnight, you know, and I would swim all the way out to the buoy. I don't know how you say it. The orange thing that floats in the beach. I'd always swim out to that because I had to slap it. I love slapping a buoy. And I know I'm not saying that right, but, anytime I got back from one of these trips by myself to the middle of nowhere, I'd be able to negotiate a higher rate because I had a renewed confidence in myself. And I spend generally, you know, actually I spend quite a lot of time alone. I crave that time alone, and candidly, I need it. I am a highly sensitive person. I put a lot of pressure on myself, and I have to do a lot of inner work. I mean, I took on $250,000 worth of student loan debt to become something, and then I had to redefine success in things like GPAs and feeling like I'm good enough. And that unwiring, it went on for 15 years. You know, it went on for at least a decade, really, at least a decade. And I would need alone time to do that, because when you're around the general milieu of people, you know, if they think that you're only good enough if you have a certain GPA or if you went to a certain school, then you start to buy into that mentality as well. If they think, well, you're only good enough if you get married at a certain age and have X number of kids or whatever it is, then you can buy into that too. I never got married or had kids. It just wasn't in the cards for my life. And I actually think that in large part, a lot of my issues with anxiety and depression played into my ability to relate in a healthy way to men after 08. Because I always had boyfriends before 08. It was after I graduated that I really kind of, in that regard of my life, whilst I climbed my way up the corporate ladder again, when it came to my personal life, I would really attract guys who would reflect all the failure that I saw of law school. And so it's an odd juxtaposition, but that is true. That is true. But anyway, I always like time by myself because I trust me. I trust me to get in and out of pretty much any situation because I've done it. Like, I've literally gotten into a physical fight with a dude. Now, he was tiny, but he was strong in Tuscany. I mean, he wasn't that tiny. This man was like very sinewy, very muscular. We got into a physical fight over his dog in Tuscany because I was going to walk his dog because this dog was in a cage the whole time. And I can't bear to see a person or an animal in a cage. It does something to me. And so I wrote this note in Italian before I set out on this trip, because I was in Tuscany for a wedding and I was staying at this beautiful villa, an agriturismo, where you cook and eat and swim, and just, it's beautiful. And I would walk by this dog every day, and this dog was just in his cage, and it was killing me. It was killing me every day. And so finally I thought I was going to do something about it. And I wrote on this note that in Italian, because I was like, well, just in case I get caught. I got caught. He came flying out of the house and he tried to drag me back into the house. And I knew to make my body weight really dead, because even though he was strong, I mean, you can't see it there, but you know, I'm not a lightweight. I am a medium, very real girl. I am Colombian. I've got a booty, and I'm not fat, but I'm not thin. Oh, and I'm not on Ozempic. So actually I do eat food. Ooh, I just said that. I might be on it someday, because I really, you know, it would be nice to drop from a size 8 to a size 6 at some point in my life. I think I blew through size 6 at like 30, and then I never saw that size again. No, that's not true. All right, I'm not going to go down that route. Anyway, so fight with this dude over the dog. So I tried to, I had the leash, I had the note, I was going to just take this dog for a walk. I just wanted to take the dog for a walk. I wanted him to know what it felt like outside of a cage. And the guy came in, we got into a physical fight. I started yelling, which is something I always recommend doing, especially if you are a woman traveling alone. Just a Udemy. Udemy also did it in the middle of the day, right? So people are awake and my voice can carry. And so then he called the police. The police showed up. I showed them the note. They looked at me being American and I kept on reminding them, I was like, I am American. So if this shit goes down like Chinatown, you think I'm not going to call the American embassy and explain like what just happened here? Anyway, this was my thoughts in my head. But Americans, you know, we don't have the greatest reputation in Europe or across the world for our many things that make us American, right? And so they didn't arrest me, but they did put me in the back of their police car, and they drove me back to my villa. And that was the story of me in Tuscany getting in a fight over the dog. And I paused there because I always swore I would go back for that dog. And I never did. And that dog just sat in a cage his whole life. And he's only let out to hunt boars. And I think that a lot of us have cages. A lot of us have cages. And maybe we don't even see the bars. But we make ourselves get up and go through the motions. Go to our cage, and we sit there. And maybe a few years go by, and maybe decades go by. And you just kind of come to this realization someday, either because your health finally bitch slaps you, or your weight bitch slaps you, or maybe your partner bitch slaps you, but something happens in your life, and then all of a sudden you realize how unhappy you are. And that you have been sitting in a cage. Part of this podcast and part of The Jump is teaching you how to get out of the cage. Teaching you how you can teach your kids that they don't have to grow up and be in a cage either. Teaching you that, you know, me going to Georgetown or a really great school, whilst I am grateful for that that school experience, it didn't make my life peachy or easy. What eventually made my life really fulfilling was the mindset work and the soul work and the heart work. Rinse and repeat, mindset, soul, heart. That's how I was able to pull myself out of what was a really, that situation sucked. It wasn't a perfect or an easy process. Anyway, this ended up being an episode about cages. And if you want to learn how to get out of yours, listen to episode 3. I love you. Go do something brave today. It will end up okay. Thank you so much for listening today. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you did, please forward it to friends, and I would be so grateful for a review on Spotify and Apple. Also, make sure you follow me on LinkedIn under Dawn Marie and my website, www.dawnmarie.co. Please note, there is no E in Marie. No excuses. Check out the freebies tab on my website for guides on negotiating income and gaining clarity in your role. You can also follow me on YouTube at I Am Dawn Marie. For the ladies, if you're a female executive in finance or law, you can subscribe to my newsletter Prime, which is all about taking bold action as a woman. I'll put links for these in my show notes. Until next time, I love you. Get your nose down, take a deep breath, and jump. Keep doing the things that you fear.